I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf. Cory Doctorow is a science fiction author, technology activist, and journalist. He is the author of many books, most recently The Bezel, a follow-up to Red Team Blues. The two books we'll be talking about. Why The Bezel and Red Team Blues? Because we're introduced to the fictional forensic accountant Martin Hinch. Not only are these books entertaining, but they are informative with a capital I. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Cory as much as I did. The Bezel, Red Team Blues with Cory Doctorow. That's coming up next here on CFO Bookshelf. When it comes to writing, Cory Doctorow, this guy is a writing beast. He's written more than 20 books, mostly fiction, some nonfiction. The Bezel is book two of a new series with Martin Hinch as our hero, a forensic accountant. And yes, it is a series, as books three and four are in the works. Up until about a month ago, I had never heard of Cory Doctorow, even though he has a large audience. Bruce Reed, the CFO of PracticeLink, said, "I think you'd really like The Bezel." And I did. And that's how I started this conversation with Cory. Cory, huge honor. I'll just go ahead and say it. Bruce Reed, who is an occasional co-host, he says, "Mark, you've got to read The Bezel." And of course, I'm thinking, I looked it up. It's like, oh, this is book two. So I'm going to go back and read book one. But then I started researching you. You got a podcast. You've written a ton of books. I'm thinking, Mark, you're an idiot. How do you not know Cory?
Well, that's very kind of you. And just for clarity, my official position is that these books can be read in any order. Maybe we can talk about that a little. The genesis of these books is that I had intended to really just write one of them. And for it to be the final adventure of this character, was my little funny conceit, was that I could write a book where it would be like the last volume of a series you'd read for 20 years and not bother writing the rest of the books. And my editor really liked it and wanted more of them. And then I had to figure out what to do because this was the last adventure. And so I decided to write them in out of order. And so there's the first three go backwards in time, but there's more planned that just go up and down the timeline.
Well, it's very fascinating, and I can't wait to jump in. But real quickly, Cory, what's your story? What's the beginning point? You are a phenomenal writer, and how did all this get started?
Well, I've written all my life. I was lucky enough to grow up in Toronto in the 1980s, which is the closest that I think anywhere in the world has ever come to having a formal apprenticeship in science fiction writing. It was all down to this one woman, Judith Merrill, who had been this towering figure in the field, an editor, a critic, a writer. And after the 1968 police riots in Chicago, she decided she didn't want to raise her kids in America. And she and Frederick Pohl, who's also a science fiction writer, had just divorced. And so she took their books and their kids and went to Toronto and donated the books to the Toronto Public Library System, where they formed the nucleus of what's now the Merrill Collection, but used to be called the Spaced Out Library. It's the largest science fiction reference collection in the world. And when I was 10, we took a school trip down to her library, and she said, you know, "Hey kids, I'm the writer in residence here. And if you ever write a story, just bring it down and I'll help you make it better." And this is like Gretzky offering to help you with your stick handling. And I, as it turned out, already knew who she was because she was introducing Doctor Who on public television every week. That was another one of her side hustles. And she was this great old broad, you know, she's chain smoker, raspy voice, didn't give a damn. And she would come out every week and go like, "Well, you know, tonight's episode is about time loops. I remember we invented the time loop one night at the Futurian House. It was a spaghetti potluck dinner. And Frederick Pohl was there, and C.M. Kornbluth, and Asimov, and C.L. Moore. And Kornbluth was angry at Asimov because he kept trying to grab C.L. Moore's ass. And then we all wrote 14 stories about time loops. And in the morning, I got on the first A train and I went to Rockefeller Center and I threw it over John W. Campbell's transom. And then they published 14 of these in astounding stories in the next 2 years. And that's where that time loop comes from. And we would watch this every week. My dad knew her too because she was involved in radical politics. My dad was a political radical. And she also convinced a local fan to start the oldest science fiction bookstore in the world, where I ended up getting a job. She ran these potluck dinners called Toronto Hydra. She'd even, as it turned out, I found out way later that the wonderful writers workshop in my alternative high school had been founded by her many years before I attended through a Writers in the School grant. And so she, you know, that legacy was living on as well. She convinced some local writers to start the first, magazine I ever sold a story to. She was really just a force of nature, and she took all kinds of writers that she knew and made them and put them into writing workshops. And so the writing workshop that I was in for more than a decade, like a peer critiquing circle, she also started. And like I say, I don't think before or since there's ever been a place where there was a more formal path into becoming a science fiction writer. And it was really just down to this one force of nature.
We've had on two fiction writers. We've done about 210 shows, not quite. So we had two fiction writers on. And I wanted to ask this question to Catherine Howe, who is a co-author to Anderson Cooper on a couple of books. And I forgot to ask her. I can't even fathom how a fiction writer starts. Are the stories just in your head, or do you start with a character and then find a story?
Well, in terms of how I start a given book, so you should know that this is one of nine books I wrote during lockdown. I write as a kind of displacement activity for stress and anxiety. And so, you know, life gave me SARS and I made Sarsaparilla. So for many, many, many years now, almost as long as I've been a writer, I've been a blogger. And so I was one of the founders of a website called Boing Boing that was it's still going for decades. It was the most widely read blog on the internet. I wrote 50,000 posts in 19 years there. And the method was that anytime something seemed important, rather than making a cryptic note to myself in a notebook that even if I could decipher my handwriting, I wouldn't have any idea what I meant, I would take it and turn it into a blog post, which is to say, I would try to explain why it was important for an audience of strangers. And you can't cheat the way you can when you're writing for yourself, because you might say to yourself, oh, I'm going to know what I meant, but the strangers aren't going to know what you meant. And so you have to really lay it out. And this has lots of positive effects. So one is that people come along and tell you that you're an idiot. And so you get better at trying to figure out what it is important about something. Another is that it forms a literal database. So like there's a MySQL backend to a WordPress site with now pushing 60,000 notes I've made to myself, detailed notes I've made to myself. And then finally, and this will answer your question, I hope, it also creates a kind of mnemonic soup where, you know, paying close attention to these things rather than just making a few notes means that they kind of turn into like fragments that rattle around in your subconscious, and your subconscious becomes a super saturated solution of little bits and pieces that are just all bumping around in there. And sometimes they'll crystallize, they'll like glom together, nucleate, and then you get like a whole story or a novel or an essay or a nonfiction book. And you know, in the case of this book, I was on Catalina Island, where much of this book is set. And we'd gone to the beach and forgotten our towels. And I was walking back to the hotel and I had the entire book materialize in my head.
Oh my gosh.
And it was because I'd done all the work beforehand.
I'll be transparent. I'm in the Midwest. I did not know about Catalina Island. I now know there's no crime in Avalon, which
there's certainly no crime in Avalon.
It's a hilarious line. Again, I find the whole process of fiction writing fascinating. Well,
and I recommend Catalina to you wholeheartedly. I was just there last weekend. I got back last night. We took another trip. It's one of our favorite places to go, which is also how, you know, I came to be writing this story in this place at this time. And it's an amazing place. It's a real chocolate box village town nestled in these Mediterranean hills on an island where 95% of it is undeveloped and just wilderness trails that you can either hike or take a guided tour through in a vehicle or cycle. And the history is amazing. It's like, it's where the CIA was founded. It has the first movie theater ever built for talkies. It's a proper movie palace with like frescoes and 800 red velvet seats and a pipe organ. We saw Jimmy Stewart in a weird experimental Hitchcock picture called Rope on Saturday night. I'd never heard of it. They were doing a Hitch festival. Rope is really good. I strongly recommend it. Only 80 minutes long. All of the shots are as long as a shot could be given the size of a film cartridge. It's like it's shot in like 8 continuous shots in the thing. And it's all done in real time. It's a murder story. It's so good. So anyway, Catalina is just this amazing place. And it's, you know, there's yachts bobbing in the harbor and bison in the hills. There's an island dwarf and an island fox. So the fox is the size of a squirrel, or an island dwarf and an island giant. So the fox is a dwarf. It's the size of a squirrel, and the squirrel is a giant. It's the size of a fox. We saw both of them this weekend. It's an amazing place.
And by the way, we're talking about the beginning part of the bezel, which I think one of the great compliments you can give to an author is when I got to the opening lines in the bezel, guess what I'm doing? I'm stopping and I'm looking up. I'm doing some searching on Wrigley, because you bring up Wrigley.
He owned the island. The Wrigley chewing gum guy.
And of course, it got me into Rockefeller, the Sherman Act. And it's like, so again, a compliment. You caused me to want to some more reading. Well, let's get into Martin Hinch. He is a forensic accountant, and I'm thinking, I hadn't picked up the book, hadn't read the back cover or the front cover. Okay, is this going to be good? Because don't we need murder? Where is the conflict? So Martin Hinch, 67 years old. Just tell me how you try to find conflict to make this a very readable, interesting page-turner book.
The thing you need to understand is it's a noir story. So the classic noir story is a detective story. And in the noir detective story, the detective serves as a kind of unlicensed policeman. And so there's crimes that the police can't solve because there's people the police can't ask questions of and places the police can't go. And the detective shatters all of that. He goes to those places, asks those questions, and solves those crimes. And the thing that makes it noir is at the end of that story, the detective realizes that these were places the police didn't want to go, questions the police didn't want to ask, and crimes the police didn't want to solve. And I think of Martin Hinch as an unlicensed IRS inspector. And I sometimes call these books Panama Papers fanfic. And if you've read the Panama Papers or the Paradise Papers or Lux Leaks or Swiss Leaks or the IRS Leaks, you'll know, especially the audience for this podcast will know, that the crimes on those balance sheets, they might be complicated, but they're not complex, right? They have been made complicated so they'll be hard to understand. They're not hard to understand intrinsically. And what you have is a lot of pretty straightforward maneuvers being done repeatedly, just so it's hard to avoid the impression that this is being just so people who don't want to solve these finance crimes can say, well, how could we have ever been expected to look at how complicated all this is? And then when you look at it, it's just not that complicated. There's a bit in the Panama Papers I love where I call it millionaire on billionaire violence. So there's Mossack Fonseca, you know, these enablers of global tax evasion by blue chips and crooks. And they're telling their clients, well, look, we could put your money in a Scottish trust because they're anonymous. But the problem is that veil of anonymity might be pierced by a tax authority that has some nexus, enforcement nexus with you. So we're going to make all the officers of this Scottish trust companies in the Grand Caymans, numbered companies in the Grand Caymans, because Those people, the people who can pierce the veil and the Grand Caymans, are not the same people as the people who can pierce the Scottish Trust. So you'll be fine. And then they go, and by the way, we're going to make the officers of those Grand Caymans companies Scottish Trusts. And you're like, wait a second. I thought you said that the adversary could pierce the veil and it got Scottish Trust. What's the... Oh, then you go, it's $100 million in additional billings over 10 years. That's what it is. This is not about the security of the criminal whose money you're hiding. You're just ripping them off. There's no honor among thieves. And so when you connect the fact that no one wants to solve these crimes with the actual stuff on the ground, the pain these crimes cause. So in the first one of these, the Red Team Blues, which is a cryptocurrency heist, there's a lot of material in there about homelessness and poverty in San Francisco and about the juxtaposition of these vast fortunes and this just soul-destroying misery on the streets and about the connection between those two, right? The money that disappears into the black hole is money that was probably earmarked for making the city a better place. And in this one, you know, the same scams that Martin Hench concerns himself with at the start of the book, which are, on the one hand, forms of money laundering. So the book, this one is set in the Yahoo era when the Saudi royals were funneling billions of dollars through Masayoshi Son and SoftBank, the venture capital firm, to help Yahoo buy every promising tech company and then destroy it because Yahoo was a kind of Machiavelli LARP where every executive was a princeling whose most bitter enemy was another executive at the same firm and who was direly committed to making sure that whatever their enemies wanted to do wouldn't happen, even though these were all just officers or senior managers in the same company. That laundering, that hidden crime on the balance sheet, becomes a motif that works its way through several other kinds of scam, including royalty theft in the music industry, a Ponzi scheme on Catalina Island. And then most centrally, there's a long piece about how the prison tech sector works. And this is something that's, you know, very much going on right now. There's this, as of this week, the largest prison tech company, prison tech is a duopoly led by a company called Securus. Its debt has been downgraded to CCC. Its debt is trading at 6 cents on the dollar. It has a $1.8 billion overhang. That debt was due this month. Its creditors have given it 8 months. It's the walking dead. And it happened in part because prison activists made sure the bond rating agencies discovered the crimes that this company was committing, not the crimes it was committing against prisoners, but the crimes it was committing against its investors.
Martin Hench, I've got a list of things I really like about him. Stop me if you want to.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, go ahead.
67-year-old forensic accountant. And by the way, I love it. You say this in both books. When he doesn't want to talk to someone, when someone asks him, what do you do if he doesn't want to talk? I'm an accountant. I wanted to tease you a little bit, Corey. You may have insulted about 200,000 to 300,000 accountants out there. By the way, I love it.
I think most accountants know that even if their job is interesting, other people don't appreciate how interesting it is.
Well, you need to do a story about actuaries then. They're the ones that's going to put you to sleep.
Well, my friend Jathan Sadowski is a very sharp tech critic and academic in Australia, is working on a book about insurtech. And I'm sure that when I read that, I'm going to have all kinds of things to say about actuary and the hidden sins off the balance sheets in actuary as well.
Now, if he wants to talk, I'm a forensic accountant, and then you're going to have an interesting conversation. He drives, again, this is this came out of your mind. He drives what's called the Unsalted Hash, which is an $800,000 tour bus. His expenses, food, good whiskey or bourbon and gas. We've already talked about he finds hidden money. He gets 25% of what he finds. And I could keep going on, but
sure.
I love, without giving too much away, in book one, writing blues, he has a heart. He has a heart. I'm not going to say it, but he does something that's, this guy has a heart. He does something very, very kind. And I didn't see it coming. Maybe I should have as a reader, but he does have a heart. My wife, a number of years ago, I'm a big Tom Selleck fan. And she got me to watching, I didn't think I'd like it, Jesse Stone. He has a Jesse Stone series, and they did like eight movies, and they're great. Martin Hinch reminds me a little bit of Jesse Stone, although he's a little bit more sophisticated, but I just see a little bit of similarities. But did I miss something on Martin?
No, I think you've got the measure of him. He's a, he is a mensch. That's what his friends call him. Hinch the mensch. He's a canonical good guy. And in the third one of these books, the one that's coming out this time next year, which is called Picks and Shovels, we really see his origin story, and we see how he figures out that he doesn't want to work for the bad guys. His first job when he comes out to Silicon Valley is working for a PC company. It's in the early 1980s during the heroic era of the PC. And he finds himself working for what seems like just your run-of-the-mill weird PC company, because they were all really weird back then, you know, computers with three floppy drives and, you know, keyboards that were physically attached to them in all kinds of weird ways with lots of extra keys with funny symbols on them and stuff. He's working for a company called the Three Wise Men that's run by a Mormon bishop, a Catholic priest, and an Orthodox rabbi. And it turns out that they're an affinity scam. So they're doing multi-level marketing through faith groups in order to rip them all off. And he realizes he's working for the baddies there. And it's sort of this moment where he decides, like, I could go along to get along here. You know, I could make a tidy bundle here working for the good guys, but I'm going to switch sides. And it sets him on his path, and he becomes a kind of Ronin, right? You know, if you think about the classic accountant as a samurai, right? Someone who's highly skilled, has a lord, right? Has a master who he's beholden to, and who uses his skills on his master's behalf. The Ronin is the samurai who lives by his own code, right? And only takes the work that matters to him. And he's masterless, so he's prone to all, you know, anyone who is never held in check by an external force is always prone to talking themselves into doing bad things, right? I mean, this is one of my theories about why all of our tech platforms have gotten so bad in the last couple of years is because they don't face competition, they've captured their regulators, and they've tamed their workforce. And so it's not that the people who run it are stupider or more evil than they used to be. It's just that when they have a stupid or evil idea, no one can tell them no. And so he's a Ronin. He faces that risk, but he has managed it with a great deal of grace. And there are two more books planned, including one where you find out what happens when Marty gets high in his own supply and makes a mistake, and how that lesson sticks with him.
Red Team Blues, which is... Now, we're calling it the first book, my definition of first book, the first one you published of the two. He's 67. Then we go back to, I think, 2009 for book two called The Bezel.
Yeah.
But
it starts in 2002, and then it goes up to about 2016. It spans a long time scale, yeah.
Red Team Blues, by the way, I love the title. We're going to hit red teaming in just a minute. Real quickly, sure. As a customer of your book, I read this in two sittings. I read The Bezel in almost one sitting. That's how good.
Oh, that's great.
And I'm a slow reader. I don't consider myself a fast reader. So I'm just saying these are absorbing books. They're fun to read. I have a stupid question on Red Team Blues.
Sure.
We're talking crypto. The topic is cryptocurrencies. Can you explain to me the key?
The cryptographic key.
Yes. High level. Now, maybe I'm the only idiot who doesn't really understand that, but...
No, it's a perfectly good question. So let's just start with a little bit of encryption theory. So in encryption, you have a cipher that's a mathematical operation that transforms a string of digits into another string of digits. So that cipher can operate on a fixed basis where if you put all the zeros and ones representing a picture into the cipher, it'll always come out on the other side exactly the same, right? So then you have to keep the cipher a secret. If anyone ever finds out what your cipher is, then they can take the scrambled version, what's called the ciphertext, and they can turn it back into the unscrambled version. It's called the clear text or plain text. And so that's a lot of secrets to keep, not least because, like, you want to make sure the math is really good. And so generally, the way that we make math or science better is we tell other people how it works, right? We go around and we're like, this is the mathematical operation I designed that's supposed to be a one-way transformation. The data goes in, but it never comes back out again. It's highly scrambled. You can't guess what was done to it. You can't look at the ciphertext and come back to the plain text. And then you have other people who come around and say, no, you're an idiot. You forgot this. And you fix it, right? You do that over and over again. You iterate over and over again until you've got it right. And so secrecy is antithetical to that. If you're going to do that in secret, then you are going to make mistakes. You know, Bruce Schneier is a great cryptographer. He says anyone can design a security system that works so well that he himself can't think of a way of breaking it. That just means it works on people stupider than you. And so you really want to expose things to peer review. That's how we do science. It's how we do cryptographic science. So what are we going to do? How are we going to resolve this conundrum? What we're going to do is we're going to take a random number and we're going to combine it with the ciphertext, run it through. Then we're going to run that through the cipher itself, the algorithm. And what comes out the other end is going to be encrypted. It's going to be a ciphertext, but it's going to be the encrypted combination of this random number, which we call the key, and the plain text itself, which might be a picture or a novel or an SMS you send to a friend. And so now we've got a different secret. The secret is that random number. So we can tell everyone how the algorithm works, and they can come along and tell us what stupid mistakes we've made so that we can fix them. And then we generate a new secret, and that secret is the random number, and it's the key. And keys are, their strength is measured in length. So the longer the key is, the stronger it is. So if you have a message that's, say, a megabyte long, it's a million bytes, and you have a key that's 100 bytes long, then you're going to have to repeat it 10,000 times, right? You just loop it over and over again. If it's a million bytes long, if it's a megabyte long, then the key and the message are the same size. The longer the key is, the stronger it is. Without getting too deep into it, every time you add one digit to the key, you double the number of guesses you would have to make to guess the key. All that is to say that today, if you take your little black distraction rectangle out of your pocket and you point it at a sunset and take a picture with it, in the eye blink that it takes for that picture to be stored on the mass storage device in your phone, it is scrambled so thoroughly that if every hydrogen atom in the universe were turned into a computer and it did nothing until the end of the universe but try to guess the key, we would run out of the universe substantially before we ran out of possible keys. And so that means that assuming the math is good and assuming no one ever ties you to a chair and hits you with a rubber hose until you tell them what the key is, you are now in possession of an extremely secure encrypted file that unless you choose to let someone look at it, they will never find out what it is. Now, in this case, there's a key that hides a backdoor to this cryptocurrency so that he can seamlessly change the totals and the transactions in this ledger. So it's as though someone could go in to your Excel workbook and not only alter what's in the cells, but alter the history that's recorded in Excel so that you can go back, you know, with an audit trail and look back at what numbers were changed so that unless you have an external source of truth, of ground truth, right? Like a pile of receipts that you can then look and make sure that the receipts and the numbers in the cells are all correct. You will never know. It has been untraceably, undetectably altered. And so this is what the keys that go missing can do in Red Team Blues, keys that were very unwisely made by a friend of Marty who made a cryptocurrency, a very good one that is now worth $1 billion, and he hit a back door in it just in case things went really bad. And then wouldn't you know it, the keys got stolen. And now someone is going to use those to steal more than $1 billion.
And you are describing Danny Laser in the book. So that helps a lot. And again, the story is fascinating, and it just makes me appreciate you, Corey, even more. It's like, where'd you come up with all this? So the imagination and also the intelligence blended together. Real quickly, before we get into the bezel, red team versus blue team. Can I read a couple of lines?
Yeah, of course.
The problem with blue teaming is you need to be perfect, while the red team only has to find a single error, which, by the way, we learned earlier that Martin, he loves playing red team versus blue team. One more line, Corey, again, right out of the first book. Some people love to play for the blue team. They design careful systems, put checks and double checks in place. They run risk-limiting audits. Above all else, they love simplicity, or they love to simplify. I think this book, Corey, is instructive for small business CTOs, because I would say most small business chief technology officers, they're thinking blue team. I think the concept of red teaming is something that needs to start getting into our muscle memory or start thinking about it. So I'm just saying, practically, from a business point of view, this is healthy reading. It's not just entertainment reading.
That's kind of you. I mean, certainly in this era of ransomware attacks, it's speaking as someone who used to be a kind of CIO for hire for lots of SMEs in the early days of digitization, when companies were going from having like one or two PCs to having networks and permanent internet connections. These are, you know, really important issues. And certainly the risk to the firm is existential, and the risk to the firm's customers is also often substantial. To give you just a terrible example, today the news broke that every single person in El Salvador has been doxxed. So the government biometric database, with their entire biography, all of their biometrics and their unique identifiers and their photos, has leaked. Every single person, every child and adult in the country. And this is stuff that once it leaks out, it never goes back in the box. And there is going to be, it's going to be a kind of lurking source of mischief for many, many years. And when you think about, you know, so I recently got scammed. I wrote a little essay about this, about how I got a person cold calling me, pretending to be my bank. And because they knew a couple of facts, and because it was a classic Swiss cheese security thing where a whole bunch of things lined up. I was on the last hours of a vacation. I was in a hurry. I had just used my ATM card in the French Quarter in New Orleans at an ATM that wouldn't accept it after I went through the transaction and said, sorry, the transaction has failed. So they told me, oh, you know, your card has been skimmed. And I was primed to believe it because I had just used this ATM. And all of this stuff happened. But the key piece there was that he knew a couple of facts about me that he probably got from some SME that had its records leaked onto the internet. And that was the convincer that in the end, my bank covered it, but that allowed this guy to do $9,000 worth of credit card fraud. And there's a wave of this. So this is hitting, I bank with a one branch credit union. This is hitting credit unions across the country. And it's because there's a leak in their supply chain that is being merged with darknet data. So that someone calls you up and they know which bank you bank at, and they know your phone number, even if that's a secret. And then from that, it's pretty easy to socially engineer some other stuff. They had a beautiful little detail, which is instead of asking for the last four of my credit card as part of the KYC, the verification, they asked for the last seven. And at the time I was like, God, that's weird. Last seven, huh? It turns out that credit unions have the same 9-digit prefix for all their card products. So the last seven is the whole number, which I just, that is chef's kiss. That The rest of it, I'm like, oh, I was an idiot. But that one, I'm like, oh, that's pretty clever. So yeah, there's some serious risks that arise from not taking some defense in depth thinking seriously, and also considering how your attacker will come in.
Corey, if Kevin Mitnick were here, he would say you are not an idiot. He would just said this was good social engineering.
Yeah, so, R.I.P. Kevin. He and I have hung out, had hung out on many occasions back when he was coming to DEF CON, the hacker conference in Vegas. I often speak.
This reminds me a little bit of one of my favorite nonfiction books ever, even though I understand some of the facts have been questioned by certain parties, but American Kingpin is one of my all-time favorite.
Yeah, I've never read that, but I've heard good things about it. I love a true crime book for obvious reasons.
Nick Bolton, who wrote Hatching Twitter, in fact, if you do read it, I would love to have you on just to talk about it. By the way, I would just hit record. I would just listen to you the whole time. But so again, I'm trying to watch the clock here. I want to be careful of your time, but again, I'm thinking American Kingpin, and I'm just thinking that cryptocurrencies and organized crime, I'm not up on this like you are. I'm assuming it's only going to get worse. Is El Salvador the tip of the iceberg?
Well, certainly. I mean, maybe this is actually a really good time to talk about what a bezel is, because we're kind of dancing around this concept of the bezel, which would be very useful in explaining this. So the word bezel, which is spelled B-E-Z-Z-L-E, it's not B-E-Z-L, B-E-Z-E-L, it's not the black rectangular on your phone screen, B-E-Z-Z-L-E, like embezzle, is John Kenneth Galbraith's term for the magic interval after the criminal has your money, after the confidence trickster has your money, but before you know it's gone. And in that moment, the supply of national happiness has gone up, right? So long as like no one ever asks to redeem the deposits that Sam Bankman-Fried has, everyone feels richer. Sam Bankman-Fried feels richer because he's taken your money, and you feel richer because you think he's giving you a return on it. And so everybody feels pretty good about that. So that is the bezel. It is this magic interval. And there is, among the people who are living in the bezel, the victims of the bezel, there's always this sense that if you were to wake up from this dream, that it would become a nightmare. That like you don't necessarily want to wake up from this dream. Like, please don't. You know, to use a little Warren Buffettism here, right? Like, don't let the tide go out. I don't want to know who's swimming naked, right?
You and if I can just interject really quickly,
sure.
You say right in the book, no one will thank you for getting them. It's like, really? Explain that.
Well, look, if I come along and I say to you, the money that you sunk into a series of daisy-chained securitized loans for a bunch of houses that are all taken out at these teaser rates for these exotic mortgages that have emerged in the last several years, and on paper all of these properties are going up in value, and you are a paper multimillionaire, but all of these rates, they have a balloon at whatever, 18 months. And so far you've been able to roll those loans every 17 months because someone was always willing to extend credit. But the credit market is about to dry up and you will find no buyers for any of those houses. And you are going to be forced into foreclosure on all of them, including your primary residence. And you will be homeless, bankrupt, and have a ruined credit rating for the next 7 years, and you will never recover. You are not going to thank me for that, right? Right up to that moment, you're thinking about like whether you can go on a month-long cruise, right? And then when I tell you that, that is not good news, right? That's not something that makes your life better, especially since you probably can't unwind those positions, right? So all you've done is you've woken up to the fact that the money is already gone. And that's a key part of the bezel, right? Is the money, the moment you lose your money isn't the moment you realize it's gone. It's the moment you hand it over. And so if there's an impulse when you discover that you've given your money to a con artist to call up Sam Bankman-Fried and say, I would like redemption. And that is the moment at which you discover that you can't get redemption. He'll string you along and he'll say it's in his other pocket and he'll say that he left his computer at home. But eventually you're going to have to confront the fact that you don't have any money. And no one wants that. No, it's so much nicer, especially if, you know, you've got a creditor who has given you a loan backed by the asset that is sitting on the balance sheet of the con artist. Because not only are you going to be unhappy when you discover you don't have any money, you're going to have to tell your creditors, and they're going to try and call in their loans, and they're going to make your life really unhappy. And that's bad if the creditor is the bank. It's really bad if the creditor is a loan shark. But it's also really, really bad if the creditor is your sainted mother who trusted you with her retirement savings.
Private for nonprofit prisons. Quick comment. One of my all-time favorite books in terms of fiction, Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Uh-huh, sure.
Love the book so much. It was also so painful to read. I've never read it twice. I got so emotionally angered by some of the things that I was exposed to in the book. Why do I bring that up? I started getting emotionally angry at what I was being subjected to. I did not know much about private equity funds buying prisons. And so, again, I started doing some research as I'm reading. And guess what, Corey? Negative, negative, negative story. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, it's a pretty bad one. Where in the Midwest are you? Just, I'm asking for a reason here.
Well, I'm right in the central part of the state. We have the state penitentiary not too far from me.
But which state?
Oh, Missouri. I'm sorry.
Oh, Missouri. So I was going to say, Minnesota just kicked the seven kinds of crap out of private equity prison ownership.
Good for them.
So the Midwest is getting pretty alive and kicking about this issue. Maybe you can travel to that other M state and ask them for some advice.
I will have to do some reading on that. I didn't know where to go with this go ahead.
I mean, what I would say is that capitalism is exhausting. And I don't mean that in the socialist way. I actually mean that in the capitalist way. That, like, the point of capitalism is that you can never rest. Right. And the thing that if you read the philosophers of capitalism, right, Adam Smith, he's sitting there saying, like, what this does is it takes the fat, lazy lord who gets the same rent every year from his peasants, no matter whether someone figures out a better way to bring in food or a worse way to bring in food or whether there's new innovations or whatever. He just gets his rent and doesn't give a damn. And it replaces him with someone who, if he isn't engaged in figuring out how to make the whole world better off, which is to say, you know, make a product people like more at a lower price, he will be out on his ass and someone else will be in there. Well, you know, there are many things to like about that conception of capitalism. Famously, although not among people who haven't read Marx, Marx thought this was really important. The Communist Manifesto, the first chapter of the Communist Manifesto is just Marx and Engels geeking out about how productive capitalism is. The other thing people don't know about Marx is that he coined the term capitalism. That's where we get the word from. And so it's exhausting as a capitalist to have to be always on the lookout for the guy who's coming up behind you, who's going to offer your customer a better price, who's going to take a lower margin, who's going to poach your workers, who's going to invent something that's better than what you've got, and you're going to end up on the breadline. And capitalists hate capitalism. This is why we see monopoly formation, right? Again, back to Adam Smith. Men of commerce do not gather except to conspire to fix prices, right? Because, God, it's a lot of work when the other guy across the way from you is taking that nickel margin you get on every cup of coffee and cutting it to 4 cents, right? There goes your vacation, right? There goes the rocking horse you're going to buy for your kid. Wouldn't it be great if the two of you could just sit down one night, man to man, and explain that you were going to keep that nickel price right there, like Google and Apple have, right? Two mobile companies control 99% of the mobile market. They both charge, by an incredible coincidence, 30% as a commission on transactions, which, like, let that sink in. 30% as a payment transaction commission, right? Like, you thought 3% from Visa, MasterCard was bad? 30%. And so one of the ways that capitalists who hate capitalism can escape capitalism and move into the realm of the planned economy, where people have to organize their affairs to suit the capitalist and his investors rather than their own, is by finding a captive market. And so I'm gathering that the audience for this podcast is far more likely to travel in airports than they are to go to prison. So if you can think the last time you were in an airport and you got through a TSA checkpoint where suddenly there was no choice.
Great point.
Right? And you noticed what happened to prices and quality on the other side of that checkpoint.
Great point.
It's like that old Lily Tomlin sketch. We don't care. We don't have to. We're the phone company. Now, where else can you find an audience that has no choice? Prisons. Right? And prisoners are the ultimate captive market, literal captive market. America imprisons more people than any other country before or since in the history of the world, more than Soviet Russia, more than China. And that is a market that a lot of capitalists have noticed and said, maybe I can escape this capitalism thing. Maybe if I can just do a rev share with the prison authority, just split the money with them, they'll let me replace the phones, the library, the visiting room, parcel delivery, the commissary, continuing education, the TV in the break room, replace all of them with a free tablet that I'll give these people, and then charge them 400% markups. And yeah, their family is broke because their principal breadwinner is in prison. And yeah, the prisoner is not getting rich. Six states in America ban paying prisoners at all for forced labor. In the rest of the states, the average wage is 52 cents an hour, except in North Carolina, where it's capped at $1 a day. 13th Amendment explicitly allows slavery for prisoners. America didn't, back to Harriet Beecher Stowe, America only kind of abolished slavery, left a loophole in. The fact that we then went ahead and imprisoned more people than any other country in the history of the world may or may not be a coincidence. And so here we are, right, in this situation where the least amongst us, the people who are the most vulnerable, are experiencing the most predatory technology. And if that doesn't boil your socks, the other thing that I think you need to think about is that when you have a terrible technology idea, you don't get to impose it on, you know, affluent, well-spoken, middle-class white dudes who listen to a CFO podcast, right? Those people, when they complain, other people listen to them, right? You need to find people who can complain and no one will care. So you start with your bad technology ideas. You start them on prisoners, asylum seekers, people in mental institutions, then like blue-collar workers, gig workers, students, people on parole. And you work your way up the curve, right, up this privilege gradient. You sand the rough edges off these technologies by rubbing them hard against the bodies of these people who can't say no. And you normalize them until there's no one in the world who isn't subject to them. So 20 years ago, if a camera watched you eat your dinner, it's because you were in a Supermax. Today, it's because you were unwise enough to buy a home video system from, you know, Google or Apple or, God help us all, Facebook. And that is, I call it the shitty technology adoption curve, right? That is the bad technology working its way up. So prisoners are early adopters of the technology that is going to torment you and your children. You know, my science fiction writing colleague, William Gibson, says the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed. The future is pretty lumpy around prisoners, right? They're living in a pool of extreme future, more future than anyone wants.
The Bezel is an excellent book. I think it's a great book club book because I felt I wanted to be talking about it. When I got finished, my thought was with the states. It's like, where is the law of unintended consequences? Someone wasn't thinking of what is the worst that can happen by having private for-profit prisons. But again, we could spend a a couple more hours talking about this, but I just, again, I want to compliment you. It is
an excellent
book. Hey, we ask every guest this question. Uh-huh. I know you're a reader. In fact, I'm looking at you right now. I see a ton of books.
Indeed.
Writers are readers. What are some of your favorite books, Corey?
Well, I normally say anyone who's only got one favorite book, inevitably it's like Mein Kampf or, you know, The Fountainhead or something. Like, if you've only read one book, you should be reading more books, right? There are a lot of writers I love. So I'll give you one writer I love only because he's got a new book out this week as we record this. It comes out tomorrow. It's this guy called Stephen Brust, B-R-U-S-T. He's another Midwestern, lives in Minneapolis, and he's a fantasy writer. And he started this series about a wisecracking fantasy assassin in 1984 when I was 13 years old. And he planned 19 books in the series. The 17th comes out tomorrow as we record this on the 9th of April. The 19th of it is done. I had dinner with Steve a little while ago. He told me the 19th is done. So now he's writing the 18th. He's just going to get that last book in. We have the same editor. It's on the schedule. I have literally waited for this book my whole life. Like literally since I was 13 years old, I've been looking forward to it. And it starts off as a noir, wisecracking, fast moving, fun, popcorn kind of fantasy novel. And it turns into, without ever stopping being fun, turns into this incredible work of political economy about this fantasy world that is itself like a series of parables about our own world. And the grace notes in this book. So like you finish the book and afterwards you're like, oh, that was such a romp. And then afterwards you're like, wait a second. Now I think totally differently about the world I live in, but also the framing devices. So one of these novels is like it's like Rashomon. It's like three different novellas telling the same story from three different points of view. When you read them all, they snap in together and you suddenly have a complete epiphany. There's another one that opens with a recipe. And the novel, every chapter is about how he procured an ingredient for this recipe, but it makes this very tight murder mystery. And then there's another one where it's organized around a dry cleaning bill, and every item on the dry cleaning bill, every rip, stain, and tear is the start of a chapter that explains how that happened. This one that's coming out, which you can't start with, some of them you could start out of order, but this one you definitely couldn't. It's called Lyorn, L-Y-O-R-N. It has this protagonist hiding out in a theater. And the reason he's hiding out in a theater is he's pissed off these sorceresses. And theaters have great sorceress protection because playwrights are very worried that other theater companies are going to steal their ideas. So he's hiding in the theater. And the show that's being mounted in the theater is a musical about a play. And the play is about a massacre. And the massacre that was reported on by a whistleblower who saw this massacre, blew the whistle, and instead of doing something about the people who did the massacre, the whistleblower is put in prison. So this playwright writes a play about this in order to drum up some support for this whistleblower. So then the play gets censored. So the musical is about the censorship of the play. This character, Vlad, he's hiding out in the theater, and someone's given him a book that's the history of the musical about the play, about the massacre. And so you're reading the book about the musical, about the play, about the massacre. The thing that happens in the play and the musical is there's a lawsuit about the censorship, and there's a whole legal drama in the play that's then refracted through the musical, that's then refracted through the book. And the legal drama is itself a superb bit of courtroom drama. The same people who sued over the censorship 1,000 years ago when this play is being mounted, because these are infinitely long-lived elven types, are also suing for libel now. And so there's another court case going on in the middle of all of this. And then each chapter opens with a song from the musical, and each one is clearly a rewritten song from a beloved musical of our own age with stupidly clever rewritten lyrics, just amazingly funny. And you're reading it, you suddenly get the rhythm in your head and you're like, oh, wait a second, I know what this is. So that, all of that is just the setup for a caper. It's a heist novel. And so all of that is just the background for a heist novel with 10,000 thousand moving parts that all come together in the end with this incredible epiphany where you realize what the plot was all along. And it's just like, oh, so good. Now, you cannot read this book without reading 16 other books. And those other 16 books are also really good. So you should read all 17 of these. And if you start now, when the 18th comes out next year, you'll be done. And you can read that. And then the 19th will come out. And then we will all know where this series that started in 1984 ends.
I'm sold, sir. I'm sold. Hey, on the other side of the bumper, we will talk about your podcast, and I'm going to mention we didn't have time to talk about DRM, digital rights management, but I know how we're going to do that. On the other side of this bumper, I'm going to tell you the audiobook to read. It only costs like $4 on Audible. It will be the only book that you can ever purchase on Audible from you. So we'll talk about that on the other side. So again, you have exceeded expectations. This was a treat, sir. And I love Martin Hinch, but now I'm going to start reading some other of your books. But I'm looking forward to reading book 3 and book 4 as they come out. But again, thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf. Lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now, back to our host, Mark Gandy.
We did not touch on digital rights management, or DRM, but if you'd like to learn more, head over to Audible and check out why none of my books are available on Audible. And I love the subtitle, and why Amazon owes me $3,218.55. And by the way, it's only about $4. What a fascinating person to talk to. He's done 2 TEDx presentations. He's been featured at Talks at Google either 4 or 5 times. So Cory Doctorow, again, thank you very much. Bruce Reed, thank you for the recommendation. We need to call this a wrap. I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf.